Hi, listeners. I wanted to step aside for a moment and let you know that this conversation was recorded in May of 2021. That's important because on June 28th, 2021, GE announced that today's guest, John Lovell, who is CEO of GE Renewable Energy's offshore wind business, will be retiring in the next few months after a successful 40-year career with the company. We want to thank John for spending time with us today as he prepares for the next chapter in his career. And we hope that you enjoy the conversation as much as we did. Again, thanks for listening to Cutting Carbon. Enjoy the conversation.
So that's what's really the driving force for offshore wind. It's green, it can be deployed in large scale, and with scale as a potential driver, you can get down the cost curve and compete, even to the point in some countries of zero subsidy fuel costs.
Good day, everyone, and welcome back to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmere, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Brian Gutnick. Brian, good day.
Hey, Jeff. Looking forward to continuing the conversation.
So, Brian, I'm very excited. We're joined today by John Lovell. John is the CEO of the offshore wind business here at GE Renewables. Very excited because John's an industry expert, a real veteran in the energy space. Before he was the CEO of the offshore wind business, he was the CEO of GE Digital. And before that, he led GE's global projects operations, being responsible for building power plants all over the world. John, welcome to Cutting Carbon.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Brian.
So, John, I want to start with, I guess, maybe the simplest of questions. Had the opportunity last year, actually 2 years ago pre-COVID, to be driving from New York to Detroit through Canada and seeing just a massive wind farm, onshore turbines, turbine after turbine after turbine. So I'm sure others have had that experience of driven past an onshore wind turbine, maybe seeing one on a local mountaintop. But help us understand, what's the difference between an offshore wind turbine and an onshore wind turbine?
That's a good question, Jeff. You know, in a lot of ways, they're similar. In the offshore wind turbine design, we leverage a lot of the same design principles as the onshore wind turbines. You know, there's three main sections, a tower, a nacelle, and some blades, generally three blades. So it's able, because of our large onshore wind experience and a massive installed base, from an offshore wind perspective, we can leverage that expertise and that experience when we design our large offshore wind turbines. So we can leverage the engineering, the fleet experience, the manufacturing techniques to some degree of all of those. The big difference is the scale. They're massively large, mainly because we're not limited by roads and bridges. Where all these offshore wind turbines are built, whether it's the towers, the blades, the nacelles, in factories that are right on ports around the world. And they go right from the factory to ships to the wind farms. So size is one thing, much, much larger. The wind speeds are different. The wind speeds are much stronger and steadier out in the ocean, which is an advantage for offshore wind. And the logistics and the project management are a bit more challenging, you know, when you're dealing with the size, the scale, and the complexity of shipping these things from factories to marshaling harbors and then out on installation vessels to be installed out in the oceans. So those are the big differences. But if you're just taking a picture from a distance, an offshore looks like a onshore turbine, but it's actually about the size of the Eiffel Tower, you know, 900 feet off the ocean floor. Each of the blades of our Haliade X is 120 yards long. You know, that's a football field, including the end zones. The 220 meter diameter span of the rotor circumference is large enough to contain six football fields. So it's a massive scale. So that swept area of the rotor diameter is what produces the clean energy, the free energy from the wind's energy. And the combined thrust of the blades is equivalent to Air Force One, the four engines on Air Force One. So you have enough energy to produce in our Haliade X, enough power for 16,000 European homes. A single spin of the turbine blades can power two European homes for a full day. You know, so that's where you're getting the scale to help people see what this technology can do.
That's impressive, John. As we think about kind of the market, maybe just some numbers for our audience to put it in perspective. So there's about 700 gigawatts of wind capacity in the world today, and that represents about 10% of the world's installed capacity of generation technology today. And offshore is about 30 gigawatts of that today, give or take. But it's the fastest growing segment. It's growing at almost twice the rate that onshore is. What's contributing to that growth in offshore, John, that's making it so attractive in growth perspective?
I think there's different dynamics around the world, Brian, that are similar but different. European was ahead, led by Denmark years ago with the oil spike years ago. They wanted to diversify from their oil base, and they got a jump start on renewables. The rest of Northern Europe has great wind speed, and not always great onshore wind speed, but really good offshore wind speed. And so for energy independence means, you know, a lot of Europe depends on gas from outside of Europe, and they're looking for ways to get away from coal and nuclear. France has 70% nuclear, have a strong nuclear base, but that's not the same in every country. What's common is people want to get away from coal and other fossil fuels as much as they can. Each country isn't always great for onshore wind or photovoltaic. So offshore wind in Northern Europe has gotten a lot of political push for well over a decade, probably 15 years. So Europe's ahead. They're pushing forward. What you see in the Northeast United States and other key markets that are growing, such as Southern China, Japan, Taiwan, and Korea, are the common issues of a very large installed base of nuclear and coal. All those geographies import natural gas from somewhere else. So in the Northeast United States, it's either come from Western Canada or Tennessee. You're getting it in Korea, Japan, and Taiwan from Indonesia and Qatar. You know, so imported LNG at 13 to 16 bucks a million BTU. So it's really high cost of energy. China doesn't have a lot of natural gas. They've been looking to import gas from Western China for years. So they all need something to displace in large scale coastal nuclear and coal. And they all have good wind speed regimes in the 8, 9, 10 meter per second range that's very conducive to offshore wind. So there's a logic to the growth. It's not just, boy, we want to have green energy. There's a need for it if you want to displace gigawatt-sized power plants like, you know, Northeast Utilities nuclear power plants on the coast of Connecticut that are gone. And you have other nuclears around there and big coal plants like Brayton Point in Massachusetts and on the coast of England and Germany and other places and China. If you want to not displace them but prevent building new, you got to come up with something large. So that's what's really the driving force for offshore wind. It's green, it can be deployed in large scale, and with scale as a potential driver, you can get down the cost curve and compete, even to the point in some countries of zero subsidy fuel costs.
Interesting. So, John, as we think about that scale and building out offshore, we talked already about kind of physically how large these systems are, but can you maybe help our audience understand kind of the infrastructure of the assembly? How do you get the parts out at sea? Are the wind turbines just kind of just floating on the ocean surface, or are they anchored to the bottom? What's kind of the behind the scenes of how one of these gets installed?
Yeah, the logistics, Jeff, is quite an operation. And contractually, we're on a time clock, right? You got to ship these on time. You got vessels waiting with demurrage charges if you're not on time. And so you got three main factories in operation to produce a wind farm. You have your tower factories and our suppliers for towers. You have our nacelle factories and our blade factories. And so all those components will come out of those three factories, get on vessels, and go to what's called a marshaling harbor, which is usually on the coast adjacent to where the offshore wind farm will be located, usually 17 to 30 miles off the coast of the country, sometimes even farther. So all of these components get shipped right from the factory onto a vessel to the marshaling harbor, where they're logistically arranged such that a big installation vessel comes. All the components get put on the installation vessels. The big ships go out, probably three units at a time, and they go out to the site where they're attached to foundations that have previously been installed, which was part of your question. Now, these foundations are fixed foundations, not floating. I'll get to floating in a bit. But the fixed foundations come in three flavors today. There's monopiles, which are a big pole that you pile drive down into a silty ocean floor. Then, depending on the ocean floor geology, whether it's rocky, hilly, bumpy, you may use a tripod design, or in the more difficult ones, you would use a four-legged stool design called a jacket. Now, even in the 5 years I've been doing this, the technology of all of these has developed to the point where we can deploy the monopiles, tripods, or jackets 50 to 65 meters in deep water. And it really is dependent which one you use on what is the soil and the geology of the ocean floor. And so those are embedded into the ocean floor. It comes up and about 10 meters off of the water level, you go by what the wave height would be. There's a platform that's built on top of that monopile or jacket. And then a transition piece, which we then take our tower sections, our cylindrical tower sections, and put them on top, just like a Lego building block set, and put one, two on top. Then we bring in a 700-ton nacelle and put that on top, bolt that on, and then we bring up each of the 50-ton blades and we connect those. Then we commission it, and it's off and running to commercial operation. And we do the entire installation process, towers, nacelle, and blades, in less than 24 hours per unit.
I guess, John, the last piece is you're generating power offshore, but the demand is onshore. At some point in that process, a cable is laid from the wind farm to some sort of substation back on shore so that electricity can go to the end users.
That's right. The wind farms today that have been built use a combination of AC connections and HVDC connections. And even the ones we're seeing in the U.S. are AC today. The ones that are being built. Generally, you take the 100 or so wind turbines and you bring those all together at some one interconnect point, cable it to an onshore substation that feeds it to the grid. In Germany, the Merkur project in Germany, which was our first, was a 500 megawatt GE wind farm of GE technology wind turbines, but it was also a GE HVDC system that connected the power to the grid.
So I want to break into our conversation for just a moment. John used the term HVDC, and I want to explain that. HVDC stands for high voltage direct current. Think of it as an efficient way of transmitting electricity over large distances. The key here is that HV, the high voltage, and by that what we're talking about is electricity somewhere between roughly 100,000 and 800,000 volts. So again, very high voltage with the goal of transmitting electricity more efficiently over large distances. So now let's jump back into the conversation.
So, John, based on the different type of foundations, if you will, that you described, it sounds like that may limit where you can necessarily put these turbines, you know, how far offshore and how deep a water. Presumably that would depend on how quickly the depth drops off of shore. Is that fair to say that there are certain places that this can be done maybe more easily than others?
You're right on. And I think where the market's developing today, Brian, when you see the UK, for example, UK, Germany, the coastal places in France like Normandy, Saint-Nazaire and those areas, China, the first wave of China, first wave of Japan, Korea, Taiwan, are in coastal waters that you can still get fixed foundations. And so there is a lot of potential for fixed foundation, a vast potential. But there are also geographies where the coastline falls off very quick. For example, the west coast of the United States, California, Oregon, That coast got limited fixed and will be a floating market when it develops there. Japan, with probably 100 gigawatts of potential for offshore in total, theoretically, will probably do about 10 of fixed and then move to floating, because that too is steep, as is Korea.
Okay.
So you're going to have fixed and then floating that go in tandem. And there's a lot of challenges with floating today that will be overcome with technology and experience, but it will also be more practical after a lot of the costs have been grinded out in a fixed foundation world where volume has peaked out with fixed, and then you're able to leverage those cost positions, the industry supply chain that's globally, to now move into those particular aspects of floating challenges.
So, John, help me out and maybe describe for our listeners. I'm trying to envision, you know, you talked about an Air Force One worth of thrust that's on the top of quite a tall tower. How does the floating mechanism work? Are you talking about a very deep hull that's in there that to kind of balance and counter those forces? How does that work?
You know, Brian, there's a lot of floating concepts today.
Okay.
And so one of the things that's required in the industry is to take a whole lot of concepts and narrow that down to a few that are the industry is going to congeal around. There's things like semi-submersible. All of them are tethered to the ocean floor in some way through cables. So just to put that picture in your head, they're all tethered so they don't go floating away. But there's some sort of floating technology that's a big ballast, not dissimilar from what oil and gas floating platforms do today for deep water exploration. But you have semi-submersible technologies. You have big barges that go out there. But the concepts today, the challenges are this. These things weigh about 5,500 tons. I mean, they're massive structures. They're going to have to hold up these massive and increasingly big wind turbines on the ocean floor. And the control systems are going to be critical and more sophisticated than we have today, because your pitch and your yaw and everything's going to be multidimensional. And the control systems are going to have to be aligned and calibrated with whatever floater controls there are. Mm-hmm. So it's going to have to be almost done from a control standpoint as one integrated system, so that we test these different concepts out, so that when they're way deep out at sea, you don't want to be going out and have a man personal service, right? You want to do this remote. And so controls are going to be really critical. As floating projects move into the demo phase, those are the things that'll get tested out, is these different floater concepts, the manufacturability of them, and the controls technology that is going to be required to reliably operate them.
Great.
So, John, you talked about, as we thought about offshore, especially the floating, that one of the things was going to happen is as we develop the static offshore, that we're learning a lot of lessons. And as the teams are learning lessons, costs are coming down. So my question is, we think about what happened to onshore wind. Onshore wind saw huge growth. There was economic subsidies that helped spur that growth, and that growth spurred the learnings, which helped bring costs down and kind of built that cycle up. Are we seeing something similar with offshore? Are subsidies being provided? Are we seeing these technology learnings? Are we seeing that cycle kind of repeating itself now with offshore?
Yeah, we are. You know, in the U.S., Jeff, you had the production tax credit, the ITCs that spurred not just requirements, but then incentives that fueled that in the U.S. and everywhere around the world had their own version of those things. What you see in offshore is similar from an incentive point of view, different flavors by country, but there are subsidies, incentives to do it. Probably just as important is in offshore, these are federal waters. And so there needs to be federal government auctions of the land and permits to develop offshore wind on these offshore wind allocations, regardless of the country, right? So each country has to come up with a process to allot those lands for offshore wind use. That can be very time consuming, and it can be uncertain on the timing. So the thing you look at for getting costs down is volume certainty, right? Number one, incentives help, but the first thing you want to know is, I'm going to do one of these projects or am I going to do 1,000 of them? So having that certainty around permits in the United States, it's BOEM, the Bureau of Offshore Energy Management, that allocates those lands and leases them to developers for a period of time. There's different allocation systems by country. But as an OEM, we look at, is this market got legs for many years to come? And so you look at today, 30 gigawatts of offshore wind leases in the queue in the U.S. And we look at how many are in the U.K. and China, Japan. That's the key thing of the legs of the industry. And then it's the government policy support to say we are going to have auctions for this power and we're going to subsidize it in certain ways. So those things really help bring offshore wind onto the map that allow you to start getting at cost. But then the real cost drivers are scale, the size, which gets at dollars per kilowatt. The bigger you can make it. We had a 6 megawatt. Now on that same pedestal, we can do 12. So you're double the dollars per kilowatt. Or for a developer who bought a plot of land, they can get twice the amount of megawatts on a parcel of land they invested in. The second thing that brings down the cost of energy for offshore wind is the size of the blades. The larger the blades go, the more energy is captured, so the higher the capacity factor. So that increases the amount of energy production from the wind turbines that improves your economics. Then you have the volume equation, which I talked about. Now people see that there's going to be more of these, so you're willing to invest in the technology. Your supply chain invests, so you have to increase your supply chain. And all of that generates more competition to bring to this scale. And finally, it's the cost of capital of these. And so as more offshore wind farms get developed successfully, the risk premium from financial institutions decreases. And so the financing gets more competitive. And right now we're in a low interest rate environment for financing these in any projects, which is helpful, but it's always something we have to look out for. You know, and the results are clear. You know, 2015-16 timeframe, cost of offshore wind was 150 to 200 euros a megawatt hour. Today, it's being bid into auctions at 50 euros a megawatt hour. So massive decrease in 5 years, and it was its size, its capacity factor, its scale and volume that people see the potential, and its financial risk premiums coming down.
You're listening to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeer. If you have a question on today's episode, a question on decarbonization in general, or a suggestion for a future episode of this podcast, drop me a note. You can reach me at cutting.carbon@ge.com.
So, John, the economics are compelling and demand, I think, is significant. Are there practical limitations as to how fast this industry can scale when you just think about the supply chain? And again, the stat I think about, the announced 30 gigawatt desire of projects of pipeline in the U.S. and building that out by 2030, the size of these turbines, that's an offshore wind turbine a day between now and 2030. And you think about just the logistics of that and the supply chain that can support it. Can it grow that fast?
Yeah, it can. You know, the laws of supply-demand, Brian, really play out here. Now, there may be transitory pieces, right? We are worried about vessels. Will the vessel industry develop fast enough to accommodate the larger scale blades and the larger scale Haliacs? But once the market accepts, it's amazing what happens, right? If people look at those things we already talked about of market certainty, volume, policy that's going to be aligned to grow this, people will invest to bring the volume to bear. There may be some time disconnects to make it happen, but it'll work its way through. I do think for the long haul, government policy is going to have to be consistent with this. Like with any of these things we're talking about for a carbon-free world, there's got to be you can't hiccup for 2 years or 3 years on this. It's got to be consistent policy because the capital expense in these long cycle games is massive, so that when you see a hole, like a running back, you want to run right through it, right? You're not going to wait till that thing fills up because it'll get jammed. So that's really critical, is policy has to be constant on this thing. I think that the things that I do think that'll be big challenges that have to be addressed, not that they can't be overcome, but I think across the world, there's going to be a first wave of grid interconnects that through brute force, people will get done. But then I think there's going to be a next wave of challenges. They're going to require much broader thinking of the grid systems in the countries to enable large scale percentages of renewable energy to integrate into them. So that could be a stalling point at some point, right? That people have real trouble. Do I have the grid interconnect? Now, there's lessons to be learned from other countries like Germany that have gone through this. So you don't always have to recreate the wheel. But I think the U.S. has some particular challenges with state and the regional ISO jurisdictions versus a unified national grid to accommodate large-scale interconnects. But it's something that's not offshore wind itself. If you're going to get up to 50, 70% renewables, the grid's going to require a massive investment to enable this. So that's probably the bigger ones.
And I had just one thought and a question, right? Again, for our listeners, the ISO, that's the independent system operator. That's the organization that kind of, if you will, owns the grid and sets, help defines who's going to provide power. There's the New York ISO, there's PJM, there's the European equivalents, et cetera. But John, I had a question for you that kind of follows your train of thought on grid and interconnect. We know one of the big challenges that people have raised around renewables is the variable nature of supply. And I think that's one of the things that we're looking to offshore to help kind of reduce that issue. As you go to the higher capacity factors, the larger swept areas, the frequency at which you're going to get more reliable power from an offshore wind farm is going to be much higher than, let's say, from a counterpart onshore. So does that help solve the problem of this variability of wind?
It helps. It doesn't solve it. You know, if you think, you guys can correct me, but solar's capacity factors are probably in the 20s. Onshore's are probably in the 30s, maybe in the high 30s. Offshore's in the 50s. So it helps. But you still have to have other sources to blend this with on a 100% capacity basis. But it does go a long way to being more predictable and providing full load for a half or more of the year.
That's great. Obviously, as we've talked about, we all want renewable power to grow as fast as possible and to do all the good things that it can for providing us a carbon-free power.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
John, what excites you as you look ahead at the advancement in offshore wind technologies? You know, you had talked some about the emergence of many concepts around floating. What excites you the most about the potential for onshore to contribute to addressing climate change?
It's just that it's beginning, Brian. You know, there's so much potential for it. It's a global game. Almost every country's going to get into this game. And so we're just at the start with where the geology and the wind speeds are optimum. But then when we've maxed out that, then they'll go to floating. And then there'll be low wind speeds. But by that time frame, we'll have really great technology and we'll be able to slap bigger blades on smaller generators and get the capacity factors right for low wind speed applications around the world. I think it's going to be an intersection for kind of what we talked about a while ago, which is it's going to be an intersection for things like hydrogen fuel, right? Of green electricity being able to power electrolyzers to make hydrogen that can go into a gas turbine. It's going to be at the middle of that. It's going to create jobs. I mean, that's what's a big excitement for governments around the world today is. And the early movers and the early adopters are going to be winners because you're not going to build factories everywhere. But those governments that put the policies in place and the incentives in place and the projects in place first are going to be the winners in where different people set up shop for today and for a long time in the future. I think it's going to force the equation on the grid, which is necessary. We've talked about the smart grid for a long time, but done relatively little. And the grid needs to be, you know, it's antiquated in many ways. When you integrate an offshore wind farm into a grid in the U.S., 100% of the reason you're going to have to upgrade the grid is not because of that offshore wind farm. There's going to be systemic age-old issues that are going to be there too that need to be addressed. And so that's going to be a big policy. How do we tackle that? And how do we resolve it as a country to get closer, in my view, in the U.S. anyway, to a single grid-looking system so that you don't need as much renewable energy to get the whole country prospering from it, because you can wheel it wherever it needs to be. And you don't have, once you generate it, it's not going to be stagnant. We can pedal it from one jurisdiction to the other. I think that just the technology play is going to be a load of fun. You know, whether we're trying to make these massive structures bigger at less weight by using different materials of the future, by using superconducting generator technology to scale without adding weight, using massive blades with carbon technologies. You know, we'll have to develop new leading edge technologies because the tip speeds are going to be way over 100 miles an hour and you don't want these things eroding, to the floating, more sophisticated logistics. It's just going to be a lot of fun. I mean, there's going to be a ton of things for great engineers to develop for the next 5 decades. But when you have the U.S. looking to go to 30 gigawatts by 2030, Europe looking to go to 300 gigawatts by 2050, Japan looking to go to 40 gigawatts by 40, Korea looking to go to 17 by 35. This is massive. And theoretically, the world's oceans produce enough potential to provide enough capacity equivalent to what we have today installed. You know, so now is that practical? Probably not, but it's theoretically possible. Yesterday, I was out over the weekend, I was out cleaning, doing some chores in the backyard, and a gust of wind picked up coming off the lake, and I have a balcony up a porch at my house, and the umbrella was left on the table. Well, that umbrella and the whole table, which probably weighed 120 pounds, go flying over the railing through the air into the backyard. And this shows you the power of just a little gust of wind. You know, so there's a lot we can do for much better uses than destroying my lawn.
Excellent. Well, John, I want to thank you for helping to break this down for us and for our audience today. And thanks as well for your leadership in the industry of making this a reality, the offshore wind. It's been a great dialogue. Appreciate your participation today with us.
Well, Brian, I appreciate you and Jeff putting this on. I think that it's really important to raise awareness of these and different and the different things we all have to do. I mean, this is just one element of it. And I think you're doing a fine job of bringing the different topics to bear that we're all going to rally around and make sure they happen. So thank you.
Thank you, John. I learned a lot today. It was a great discussion. As always, for our audience, if you've got questions, feel free to reach out to us. You can reach us via email at cutting.carbon@ge.com. For John and Brian, this is Jeff Goldmere, and this is Cutting Carbon. Thanks for listening. If you want more information about today's episode, check out the resources available in our show notes. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmere, and this is Cutting Carbon.